Today's Teisho will be on Case 25, The Master of Rengeho's Staff. This is Case 25 in the Blue Rock Collection. Engo's Introduction. If the action of one's ki is not independent of one's degree of enlightenment, one falls into a sea of poison. If one's words do not astonish the crowd, one slips into the conventional. If you can distinguish black from white in the moment of a spark's being struck, and can tell life from death in the instant of a flash of lightning, then you will be able to command all quarters and stand firm like a thousand-foot cliff. Who could ever be so? See the following. Main subject. The master of Rengeho's cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, "When in olden times a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there?" No one could answer, and he replied for them, "Because it is of no use in the course of life." And again he asked, "After all, what will you do with it?" And once again he said for them, taking no notice of others, throwing his staff over his shoulders, he goes straight ahead and journeys deep into the recesses of the 100,000 mountains. Secho's verse. His eyes filled with sand, his ears with clay. Even among the 1,000 mountains he does not remain. Falling blossoms, flowing streams, he leaves no trace. Open your eyes wide, and you'll wonder where he's gone. I want to thank everybody for coming here to practice today and for sitting so well this morning. Everybody did a wonderful job. I can't really, in a certain sense, I can't really know what your sit was like. I look around the room to see who seems to be sitting deeply. So some of you were sitting motionless for hours on end. And in some cases, I noticed toward the end of the sitting period, some people were fidgeting, some people were rocking, some hands were moving and so on, you know. So I think maybe people are losing concentration at the end of a certain period. That's my guess. I mean, you can tell a lot about a person's concentration from their body. It is true that, generally speaking, when people are in deep samadhi, they're motionless. Maybe a couple of years ago, there was a person who came to sit with us who actually wasn't mentally healthy. He had a kind of bipolar disorder. He didn't stay with us very long. He had to be hospitalized and didn't come back to practice with us after that. But he had conceived of a kind of fantasy about himself, which is quite common, by the way, with people with bipolar disorder. He had decided that he was already deeply enlightened. And he came to sit with us on a couple of occasions, and he was actually, his bipolar disorder was getting worse during the period he started to sit with us. And he was a nice kid. I felt very sorry for him. He was student, not at Rutgers, but at another, I think at one of the county colleges. And he, at first when I met him, he seemed like a very nice person. You know, he was maybe 19, I think, maybe 18, and he seemed like a nice guy, and he was very open, but he sat with us for maybe, I don't know, maybe a month or two. It's a little hard for me to remember, but it was getting worse as he was practicing. And I think he was heading into this bipolar high. You know, they have periods of real depression, and then these very high, they go up these peaks. And in their peaks, one of the characteristics of people with a bipolar problem is that they have like what's called delusions of grandeur, you know. And indeed, as he was going on, he was deciding that he had enlightenment experience. And he came in and sat right next to me one night. I asked him to sit next to me. And through the whole thing, he was fidgeting quite a bit. And I mean, he was constantly fidgeting and constantly moving. And after the sit, I said, "How was your sit?" And he said, "I was in very deep." He said, "I was in totally deep concentration." And I said, "You know, I hate to disappoint you, but you weren't. You know, I said you were not in deep concentration at all. You know, you were constantly moving. And if you were in deep samadhi, you wouldn't have moved at all." And I feel that he didn't know how to respond to what I said, but I thought it was important to tell him the truth. And a little while after that, I called his mother, who was very worried about him, and indeed he did have to be hospitalized. The thing is, you can tell a lot about somebody's state of mind. When you are really in deep samadhi, the body is motionless. And if you feel the impulse to move, often it's, sometimes, let's face it, it's a pain in your legs or a fatigue in your muscles. Maybe you're having a muscle cramp. And if you have to move, that's perfectly okay. You know, sitting in agony is not necessarily productive practice. So if you're in agony, just uncross your legs or, take a break for a minute and then gather your mental focus and find a posture you can maintain comfortably. There's nothing wrong with that at all, you know. But, when you get fidgety, when you're sitting next to somebody who's very fidgety, that's usually caused by mental agitation. You know, the body and the mind are closely intertwined, and agitation in the mind produces kind of fidgetiness or the desire to move. So if you've had a very unpleasant experience, or you've had something that's caused you a lot of agitation during the day, and you sit down on the cushion, you may find that you have this, you find yourself really fidgeting. And, when you feel that way, just go back to your breath. And when you have that impulse to move, you feel like moving, try instead to focus more intensely on your breath. So if you feel like, you feel that you have to move your arm, instead of moving your arm, focus intensely on your exhalation. It's like move your breath instead of your arm is one way to think about it. And if you keep doing that, you'll notice that the desire to move gradually goes away. And the mind will be serene for a little while. And then whatever is causing you agitation may come back and produce another desire to move, or another kind of fidgetiness or physical discomfort. And each time you resist this desire to fidget or to move, you're actually calming your mind as well as your body. And it'll work, honestly, it'll work like a charm. you'll be amazed. And if you are in physical discomfort, there's a range of discomfort, you know. There's moderate discomfort, which might mean that you know, you feel a little, you feel some sensation maybe in your knee, or a little bit, just like a little bit of discomfort, you know, a little bit of pain, or a little bit of muscle strain, you know, and it doesn't go away, you know, it's there for a while, but it's not really intense pain, right? You know, again, the best thing to do in that situation is to try to focus intensely on your breath. And you, again, will notice that much of the pain sensation will go away for quite a while. At the very least, the pain sensation will go away for the duration of your out-breath. So if you really focus on the out-breath, as you follow that out-breath out, you'll notice that pain sensation disappears, and usually it arises again when you're inhaling. So you push with the breath, and the pain sensation goes away, and then it comes back, and then you push with the breath, and the pain sensation goes away, and it comes back. And this goes on and on, and it might go on and on through the whole sit. We call a period of meditation a sit. So it might go on through the whole period of meditation, but interestingly, at the end of the period, you might not feel that your meditation has been very deep, quote unquote. But actually, your mind will be very still, and your concentration will be quite deep. See, that's very interesting. You know that the classic view of meditation is that you're supposed to come into the room, sit down on the cushion, watch your breath, and enter bliss. Right? This is the ideal situation, and indeed, it does happen sometime. You know. But more typically, physical problems can get in the way. So you come in, you sit down on the cushion, you think, okay, maybe I'll have an experience of deep bliss, and then you notice that through the whole sit, your left knee is hurting, right? And this, who knows why, you know? And then you have to just sort of work with the pain or the discomfort. And as it arises, you focus intensely on your breath, and you use your abdominal region, you know, somewhat tighten those muscles a little bit around your navel, and squeeze the abdomen gently, and the breath will go out, and often it's not a very strong, forceful breath, but very gentle, long breath that will allow you to cope with the pain. And as the pain arises, if you focus on the breath intensely, you'll notice that the pain abates or disappears momentarily. This is quite remarkable, and the more you do this, the easier it becomes to deal with this kind of discomfort. You know, I was reading in a magazine just recently. I got a magazine from my old alumni, my own alma mater. Sorry. I'm an alumnus of my alma mater. So this was the college I went to as an undergraduate, and they have a magazine about what's going on at the college. And there was a story about a person who graduated about maybe 10 or 15 years before I did. I guess actually about 10. I think he graduated in 65. So he was a top student, and he wanted to go into the military, and he was going to go to Vietnam, and he was training, and his plane malfunctioned during some sort of training exercise out in Arizona, and his plane malfunctioned, and he bailed out successfully with his parachute. But what happened was that apparently a piece of, as the plane hit the ground, you know, it exploded, and pieces of the plane flew up, And it basically, a piece of it, the plane hit him in the head and caused some kind of a neurological crisis. But also, he landed pretty much right on the plane, and so he had burning, he had burns on his body for like 40% of his body. And at that time, back in the 60s, they didn't have the burn technology that they do now. You know, they're much better. They have all kinds of skin grafting techniques that are quite good now. But back then, it was pretty primitive. And you have to, you know, it was pretty horrible. Usually, if you had a burn on 40% of your body, that was a fatal burn. And in those days, you would be in a burn ward where they would cover your body with kind of a blue fluid. And basically, these people would be on all kinds of painkillers. But they didn't have the painkiller technology they do now either, you know. So this guy said he was taking Tylenols. Now, if you know Tylenol, it's like, if you have a, you know, muscle ache, it might help. But if you have burns on over 40% of your body, there's not a chance, right? So he was taking extra strength. The hospital was giving him extra strength Tylenol. And my wife actually worked at one time as an orderly in a burn ward. And she said it was just a very pitiable situation because, you know, these people, you know, they're in agony a lot of the time, and they thrash around, and you know, this blue fluid on their bodies gets thrown on the wall, and my wife's job was to clean off the walls and everything, and she felt so sorry for the people in there. And anyway, this guy was expected to die, but he discovered this article was about his experience. He discovered that he could deal with the pain by focusing on a point in the ceiling. It's amazing, you know, amazing. He said the pain was just unbearable and inescapable, and it said it occurred to him, he was looking at the ceiling, and he realized that he could go to that point in the ceiling and stay there. And he focused his mind intensely on becoming one with that point in the ceiling. And he said that when he would do that, the pain would just drop away. It was like he'd left his body, and the pain would just disappear. And he said as long as he could maintain his concentration on that point on the ceiling, he would be out of pain. He'd experience relief. And I thought when I read this, I was quite impressed, because this is quite a bit like watching your breath, like following the exhalation, following the breath out. If you're in moderate discomfort and you follow the breath out, it will work. But for this guy was in like a hell of real pain, and he couldn't uncross his legs and rest. Right, there was no escape. So he threw himself into this meditation practice. And basically, it worked like a charm. He was astounded. He would do this. He would just spend hours every day, and sometimes he would pass out and things like that. But when he was conscious, fully conscious, he would focus on this spot on the ceiling. And he said he believes it saved his life. A little later in the article, he describes an experience which is like unmistakable enlightenment experience. He didn't know what to make of it. I've even thought of writing him a letter, as a matter of fact, because he describes it, and it was a deep experience of enlightenment. And I won't go into the particulars, but you know, in that experience, in that moment of encountering fundamental reality, he felt this tremendous sense of well-being and joy and connectedness. And I guess it's very similar to the kind of death experiences that are described by people Well, but there are different scholars who have researched near-death experiences or dying experiences, and this sort of fit those classical patterns. He didn't see any religious figures or anything like that. It was just a pure experience of enlightened mind, I would say. And in that state, he felt totally. Totally at home, totally safe, and of course it changed his life. Like so many people who have these experiences, he came out of it very, very compassionate person, and remarkable story. So anyway, this is something we can practice ourselves. This is just what we're up to. You know, when you focus on the breath and the breath goes out, you eventually will notice that it's easy to deal with the pain. And the same is true for, the thing, mental agitation. So you may, last night I was speaking to a young woman who has been coming to sit on a regular basis. She's really been practicing with her older sister. And at the end of the sit, I said, how was your sit today? And she said, well, it was pretty good. She said, but I had a really hard day. And all of this stuff just kept coming up as I was sitting. So she too, I think, had imagined that she was going to come in, sit on the cushion, and have a experience of a bliss. And it didn't happen. You know, she came in, she sat down on the cushion, and even though she didn't have physical discomfort, she had a lot of mental agitation. So whatever happened to her, I didn't ask and she didn't tell me, but something must have happened that upset her or that caused her to become mentally ill at ease. And those events are sort of somewhat traumatic, you know. They're not really traumas, but they stick with you, and you can't put them down, and you keep rehearsing them, you know. Especially if they have had a prominent or rather a powerful emotional character. You know, so if somebody insulted you or your boss did you some kind of an injustice to you, you know, it hurts at the time, and then later you sit down and you rehearse the event, and of course the emotional state comes back. And maybe even more intensely, and you just keep sitting there reliving it and reliving it and reliving it. Yeah. So normally, what people do in those kinds of situations is they have a drink. You know, basically. I mean, my dad. One of the first things my father ever taught me how to do was to make him a martini. You know. So when he could come home from work, he taught me how to put the vermouth in the glass and swirl it around and empty it out, and then put the vodka in there and the ice. And it would help a little bit, but it doesn't really, you know, because it doesn't really free you from the compulsive character of your reactions. It just masks them. And, watching TV is the same way. You know, if you've had a stressful day and you turn on the tube, it distracts you, but you don't really get to the source of your problems, you know. So when you sit on the cushion, you might be expecting like a bliss, you know, but actually what happens is a little different. If you could just come in, sit on the cushion and experience bliss, meditation would not be good for you. It would be a drug, right? It would be a drug. You could do something terrible, for example. You know, you could rob a bank and come in and say, I feel like a little stressed, I'll do some meditation, you know. I feel so much better now, you know. Now, that wouldn't be good, right? I mean, so, and in fact, it doesn't ever happen that way. So you come in and you sit on the cushion, and whatever is in there is going to come out. It may surprise you what's in there, you know. This is one of the good things about meditation, that when you sit down on the cushion, you might be expecting something, and you might be a little surprised at what comes out. It might not be clear what's happening, but something's happening, you know. And it's an expression of what's going on at sort of a deeper level of your consciousness or unconscious awareness. You want bliss, and you come in, and then this all these memories of the day come up, right? And you think, oh damn it, now I have to go through this all again. You know, I came to meditate because I'm trying to get away from all this stuff. But you know, again, if you go back to your breath, or if you go back to Mu, and you just you keep going back to Mu, what happens is that all of this stuff that's coming up is present more fully. It can even be more strongly present than before. You know, some people come in here to meditate for the first time, and they have a very negative experience. They'll say, this made me stressful, this made me more anxious. And it's really not so. They were anxious when they came in, but it showed them their anxiety. This is, I think, very valuable, you know. I'm sure you've known people who will be furious, and you say, why are you so mad? And they'll go, I'm not mad. Right? They're masking their real state because they don't, maybe they want to think of themselves as a kind and gentle person, for example, but inside there's a lot of rage, you know? And it's very hard for us to see that. And one of the wonderful things about meditation is that when we sit on the cushion, we can see our mental obstacles, you know? And these things that arise become present, and we become aware of them. And then if you just keep going back to the breath, little by little, you start letting them go. You know, maybe your boss insulted you, and sit down on the cushion, and you can see your boss's face, and he's going, poor performance, you know. And you think, oh God, poor performance, you know. And all these other things are in your mind, like, maybe your father lectured you when you were a kid, you know, about trying, you're not trying hard enough, and you think, oh, I am a failure. You see yourself sleeping in Penn Station 10 years from now, and so on. You know, but you just keep coming back to your breath or back to Mu, and little by little, it lets you go. You know, it stops having this powerful emotional charge, and you begin to feel better. And instead of thinking about this as a distraction from your meditation, let me say that this is often the essence of meditation practice, is confronting our obstacles and working through them. And we don't use the discriminating mind, the analytical mind. It's not so important that we understand where these came from. Because my feeling is that memories aren't really laid down in your brain a tape recorder, you know, that has the whole history of your life on it. Really, memory is just like fragments, and it's like a set, like sediments of earth. You know, the mind is like a if you see a cutaway of the soil. You know, the mind's like that. There's just fragments in there. There's little bits of this and that, and so an event that might have been very painful for you long ago, you might not remember the whole event. In fact, you might remember very little. You might not even remember much of it at all. But you still have the emotion there, and certain events can trigger responses, you know. So all of a sudden, you're sitting on the cushion, and you feel tremendous anxiety. This is quite possible. And you think, why am I anxious? You know, and there's no memory. Just the anxiety is arising. And, if you just keep going back to the breath, though, it goes away. And if it's a really event that's really terrible, something that has really haunted you, you know, in your life, you might have to go on for a long time. It's not going to be one sit, you know. You might sit down on the cushion. Maybe you get fired. You know, you get fired. That's very painful. It's happened to me. And you sit down on the cushion, and you work on it. You sit for half an hour. You sit for another half an hour, and finally you feel clear. You know, and you get off the cushion and think, well, that wasn't so hard. And the next time you sit, there's your boss saying you're fired again. You know, so you go back on the cushion. Little by little, you let it go. You know, you just let it go, and the emotional responses stop arising, and the mind is calm and stable. And eventually it just has the character of kind of a neutral memory. And it stops recurring in your awareness, and you can just let it go. It's really wonderful. This is hard work of meditation practice, but it's quite wonderful, you know. Now, you know, a lot of Zen practice is like this, is working through these deep obstacles. Or, you know, also, we say in Zen, we're purifying body, mind, and heart. So, you know, when you sit on the cushion and you feel like fidgeting, and you don't fidget and you watch your breath, we would call that like purifying body, mind, and heart. And when you're reliving experiences from the day and they're causing you agitation and all kinds of emotional distress and you keep going back to your breath, that's purifying body, mind, and heart. And little by little, if you do this, you really can become a more open and kindly person. You know, I think these our relationship to life is often based upon pain or fear and avoidance behaviors, you know. So, you know, basically that makes us very sort of like rigid and sort of creates a very rigid way of living. And people can be very powerful personalities but very unhappy because they have this rigidity in their lives. And they're not really very happy in the world, and they're not very comfortable in their own skin, and not really very flexible or resilient, you know. And you don't have to look far to see such people, you know. I don't mean to insult anybody, but I think they run the government, you know. When you keep going through this process of encountering your obstacles and working through, you restore a kind of basic trust in life. You know, we keep expecting life to injure us or hurt us, and of course events happen that can be potentially quite hurtful, or they're hurtful, you know. But when you sit on the cushion and you work through something that's hurt you, it gives you, I think, greater confidence in life and greater trust. And you know, if something terrible's happened, like you get fired, it seems like the end of the world. But you know, if you keep sitting, after a while, you can live with it. You thought maybe you couldn't live with that event, you know. But after a while, not only can you live with it, but you can be happy. And then you're not so afraid the next time of being fired. And that's very important, right? I mean, if you go to your second job and you're afraid of being fired again, that whole experience is going to be terrible, right? But if you can somehow work through your experience of being fired and not be afraid anymore, you know, then you have a kind of new freedom. You've really gained from that experience, you know. If you're not afraid of it happening again, you can really go forward with a kind of freedom. I was on the job market many years ago, about 22 years ago. And I went for an interview at a place I really wanted to teach. It was called Pomona College in California. And I had worked very hard to get my PhD. I had gone to 7 years of graduate school, and it was really hard and very stressful. And this job came up, and I was so hoping for this job. And I went to the interview, and the interview went so well, and I just thought, this is, you know, a dream come true. And then I flew out to the institution, to the college, and I gave a talk, and it was my best talk, you know, and it was like, it went over, it was a disaster, really. You know, really didn't work well at all. They didn't like it. They were very critical. So I didn't feel very good after the event, you know. And I came home and I had to do a lot of Zazen to get over that event. But, you know, the next time I went for a job interview, I got a job interview to a school called Rutgers. And I thought, Rutgers has a pretty good reputation, actually, especially outside of New Jersey. You know? Really, it's odd, you know. If people say the farther you go from New Jersey, the better Rutgers looks, you know. But it's true. Yeah, out on the West Coast, if you say Rutgers, oh, Rutgers, very nice, you know. Here in New Jersey, it's, ah, Rutgers, who cares, you know. It's really like that. It's very strange. So anyway, I got this job interview from Rutgers, and my both of the people who were main people on my dissertation were like New Yorkers. So they were going, oh, Rutgers, oh, you're so lucky, you know, you can live in New York and take the train down. And they were so excited for me. And don't blow it, you know. And so I, you know, but actually, you know, I had blown it a number of times at other job interviews. You know, not only had I not gotten the Pomona College interview, but I had blown it a couple times also. I'd gone on to a couple other places where I'd given talks and bombed. So, you know, when I went into, but I'd done a lot of Zazen on this, you know. And when I went in to do the interview with Rutgers, I amazed myself. You know, honestly, I'm telling you the truth. It was so, I was as cool as a cucumber, you know? Really, it was like, I don't care. Really, I wasn't angry. I was just so calm. And I hit it right off with the people on the committee. You know, it was just, we just had a wonderful afternoon, and I didn't think I was going to get the job. But I had a good time, you know? We had some good conversations. And they had asked me for a writing sample. They asked me, I was working on this article, and I wasn't done, but they said, well, send the article. And I didn't even send it, because I just didn't think I stood a chance of getting a job at Rutgers. And then I got a call from the chairman, and he said, where's that article? And I said, you really want it? And he said, what do you think? You know, he was kind of a gruff old guy. He retired about 10 years ago. But he said, what do you think we, you know, and okay, I'll send it. And I sent it, and I got the job, you know. But I think I got the job because I didn't go into the room thinking, oh no, here we go again, another failure, right? And I didn't go in thinking, oh, love me, please, you know, please like me, please, you know. I wasn't resentful, you know. I wasn't going, oh, I've got a big chip on my shoulder. It was just like I was clear. You know, my heart was really clear. I didn't expect anything. I didn't think I'd get the job, and I wasn't mad about it, and I wasn't reliving my experience as a failure. You know, really, it's possible to be in the moment. And I was just in the moment. And I tell you, before the interview, I got up in my hotel room, and I did Zazen, and I went to the interview, and I had a wonderful time, and after the interview, I went to the museum. You know, and then I flew home and I thought, well, now what'll I do? I've got to get a summer job working as a janitor in a law office again, you know. So that experience of failing and working it through and failing and working it through really helped me. And even if I hadn't gotten the job, it helped me because I had a good experience with other people, you know. I mean, I left with good feelings about them, and I had a good day, you know. So working through is just wonderful, actually. So, you know, one of the people who came to sit this week sat down on the cushion, and she also had this, she had this, if these things that were bothering her. And after the sit, she said, oh, I had a pretty good sit, but a lot of things were bothering me, you know. And she said, basically, she kind of said, when will this end? You know, when will it be over? I'm so sick of, you know, I sit on the cushion and I want to have bliss, and what do you know, all these things come up. I had an argument with my sister, and I'm reliving the argument. You know, when will it end? I said to her, why do you want it to end? And I think she was really surprised. But I think we have a deep desire, you know, a deep desire for it to end, right? You know, I mean, one way we imagine all of this, we want a kind of permanent resolution, right? You know, a lot of people believe in heaven. You know, a lot of people believe in heaven. and I don't want to make fun of anybody's beliefs, but if you, you know, heaven is the permanent resolution, right? But when you try to imagine heaven, when people try to imagine heaven, you know, immediately they start imagining something that's very much like life, right? So I was listening to on the radio. I was riding up to Blairstown, and they were doing the funeral for Evel Knievel. Do you know who Evel Knievel is? Evel Knievel was the guy who jumped over all these barriers. He would get on a giant motorcycle and try to go over like canyons and multiple cars and barrels, and about half the time he made it, you know, and about half the time he'd be in the hospital for a year, right? Evel Knievel. So he finally had so many injuries and everything, he finally died, you know. And Matthew McConaughey came to his funeral, the actor Matthew McConaughey, and said, you know, I know that Evel Knievel right now is in heaven, and he's on the biggest hog you ever saw, you know, and he's going to go over those cars, you know, and, but this time he's going to make it, you know. And it's charming, and it's lovely, but of course, you know, that's ridiculous, right? So it's like in heaven, there'll be motorcycles, but you won't have any accidents, right? And you won't need gas, or gas won't be $3 a gallon, it'll be a penny a gallon. Right? And there won't be any bills, you know? You know what I mean? There's something ridiculous. I mean, it's absurd, right? Because, that would really mean is that, you know, if there are technological advances on Earth, then there must be equal technological advances in heaven, right? It leads to a lot of absurdities, right? Clearly, heaven can't have motorcycles in it, really. You know, it can't have gasoline. But what people do is, when they try to imagine heaven, they rebuild the world they have in an imaginary place. Only they take away all the problems, you know. And that's charming. It's very human, right? And when people imagine enlightenment too, they maybe imagine that it's a state without any problems. And so, you know, our dream is that we're going to come in and sit on the cushion, and the mind is just going to be, it's going to be heaven, right? Final resolution. Now, I don't want to say that, Great Awakening is real, and Great Awakening is like going to the source. Enlightenment is like returning to the source. You know, people who have the experience describe it that way. It's like coming face to face with a pure consciousness, which is actually pure compassion. So it's a beautiful experience. But even people who have Great Awakening experiences can fall into a mistaken perspective. You know, people might think that after you have your Daikensho, you can't have any confusion, or you can't make any mistakes, you know. But actually, that's quite a fallacy. Many people who have Daikensho get very confused afterward. It's interesting, you know. They get very confused because they have a hard time accepting that there's still something, you know, more to learn from life, you know. If you one of the most remarkable things that happens to people after they have Daikensho is that, they go on and they get cancer, or they alienate people in their temple and have to deal with the consequences and so on. So, you know, still have problems even after that. And you could say, well, then what good is Daikensho? But I think that's I'm trying to make the case that we really don't want final resolution. That is something, what would you do with it? You know, I mean, The most wonderful thing in the world is being here now, you know, with all of the problems we have. And when we sit on the cushion, we work through our problems, we work through our fears and our resentment and our anger, and we enter a kind of calm, beautiful state. But you please don't cut the world in two all over again, you know. In other words, when you're in that calm, beautiful state, you're really very beautifully integrated into life. We say you're in your big mind, right? In that mind, you feel, you know, like you're where you should be, and you're at home in the world, and the boundary between yourself and the world has disappeared, you know. But you know, if you cling to the illusion of like final resolution, you just create that boundary all over again. I hope this is making some sense. But you know, working through our obstacles and entering this clear mind is wonderful, I think. And if I could live to be a million years old, I'd like to do it every day. You know, I would like to do it every day. There's nothing wrong with having obstacles, and there's nothing wrong with working them through. It's if you can't accept that, you're still afraid of life. See, I mean, if you imagine enlightenment as a condition in which you'll never have any more problems or anything more to work through, that's really like a fantasy that shows a lot of fear. Enlightened people aren't, you know, there aren't really enlightened people, but people who have spent a long time in enlightened mind know that the obstacles are also enlightened mind. So, you know, there's two sides to existence. You know, one is this beautiful simplicity and unity that we experience sometime when we sit on the cushion. And the other side of existence is the, you know, it's like having somebody rub sand in your eye, you know? It's, life can be so annoying sometimes, and it's so disappointing, and we can be so unhappy with ourselves, you know? But these two things are really one life, you know, and they sustain and nourish each other, you know? And it's great. So the next time you come in and you sit down on the cushion and you think, okay, here I go, bliss, unity, and you sit down and there's your problems. You know, just realize that this is such a precious opportunity to live a deeper life. It's a most precious opportunity. You know, getting fired, nobody wants to get fired, but you know, if you're a real person of Zen, you're a real man or woman of Zen, you know, of course you're a human being, so you go home and you go, oh, that hurt. But, you know, the Zen person sits down on the cushion and says, I'm going to work this through. And you often find that when you work it through, your mind is brighter and clearer than it's ever been. That really happened to me. You know, I didn't think I was going to get a job at Rutgers, so I went for a job interview at a place called TRW in Seattle. And I was making like no money a year. And TRW, this was back 25 years ago, TRW said, we're going to start you out. I went to the interview and I thought I was going to get the job, and they said, well, we better talk salary. And I'd been making like $12,000 a year, maybe less, you know. And they said, well, we're going to start you out at 35. And my face sort of started twitching, I think, you know. And the guy said, well, don't worry, it'll go up. I was like, oh, wow, you know. And I really wanted to stay in Seattle to practice with the Zen group. And so it just looked like everything was going to go my way, you know. And then I didn't get the job, and it really hurt. And I remember, you know, my wife actually cried. She had her heart set on a different kind of life. we used to go to the store, we didn't own a car, we used to go to the store with a backpack and put our groceries in the backpack. So we'd go to the store with our backpack, here comes, you know, Kurt and Barbara, and they'd take out their backpacks and put their groceries in the backpack and, you know, hike back to our house, you know. So I think my wife thought maybe we'd have like a nice car and we wouldn't have to take backpacks to the grocery store. So she was young, she wouldn't cry now, but she cried about that. And I sat down on the cushion and I was so hurting, you know. But I had the most incredible sit. I still haven't forgotten that sit. It was so great. The master of Rengeho Cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, "When in olden times a person reached a state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there?" Don't cling to enlightenment, even enlightenment. Don't cling. No one could answer. See, they still think they're trying to get to heaven. They want permanent resolution, right? When in older times a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? Permanent resolution. No one could answer. And so the master said for them, what would be the use of that? Why do you want it to end? See, the desire to end it all, the desire to be resolved, is like a fear response. It shows you're not unified. See, so you're not embracing. You're still not integrated, right? Because what would be the point of resolution? And again, he asked, after all, what do you want to do with, you know, please, what do you want to do with your enlightened mind? See, when we sit on the cushion, we're expressing enlightened mind already. I'll stop soon. Once again, he said, he recited this little verse. Taking no notice of others, throwing his staff over his shoulder, he journeys straight ahead, into the recesses of the 100,000 mountains. So it's like right into the complications of life he goes, right? And that's really a beautiful statement. That's real unity, right? Real unity. It's taking that enlightened mind, which we all experience sometime on the cushion, with us through the complexities of life. You know, and we're afraid, and when we're hurting and we're afraid, we think, oh, if only I had the final resolution, you know, but you don't really want it. You know, please enjoy this beautiful life. Please enjoy this beautiful life.